In his New York Times op-ed about the winter solstice last year, Clark Strand wrote, quote, "Few of us will turn off the lights long enough to notice it. There's no getting away from the light. The lights are always on." 99% of Americans live in areas that are officially light polluted, which means the light is at least 10 times brighter than it should be. Are we facing an epidemic of artificial light? And what can be reclaimed in the dark? In his new book, Waking Up to the Dark, Ancient Wisdom for a Sleepless Age, Clark Strand, a former Zen Buddhist monk and senior editor at Tricycle magazine, offers insight on the power of darkness and the spiritual peace that can be found when we pull the plug on our billion-watt culture and reclaim the wisdom and comfort of the dark. Again, the title of the book is Waking Up to the Dark, Ancient Wisdom for a Sleepless Age. The book is published by Spiegel & Graw, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Clark Strand to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks very much, Joe. I'm happy to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. The name of the book, Waking Up to the Dark, Ancient Wisdom for a Sleepless Age. What got you thinking about this?
Well, I've been getting up in the middle of the night all my life. I started walking at night as a child when I was 8 or 9 years old. I'd get up in the middle of the night and slip outside because I love the dark. So I was always thinking about it, but it wasn't until I married and had kids and was waking up in the middle of the night myself, and I began to sort of worry about this habit. You know, was it natural? Was I going to be able to get enough sleep? You know, what would the consequences of this strange habit of waking up in the night be for my life? But then around, I'd say, the mid-1990s, I discovered a study by a man named Thomas Ware at the National Institutes of Health. He took 16 people off the street and took them off electrical lighting, and they replicated, after about 3 weeks, exactly the same pattern of sleep that I've been observing all my life. And Ware concluded that this was the primordial pattern of sleep. This is how human beings would naturally sleep in the absence of artificial light.
One of the fascinating things about the book, there's a large part in the book, an entire section called A Dark Manifesto.
Right.
And you're writing a manifesto basically about the glories of the dark.
Right.
Why are so many of us disconnected with the dark?
Well, I think it's partly a byproduct of industrialization. You know, it's very convenient for industry and commerce to have us compress our work days and our sleep nights into convenient 8-hour blocks. It's not a particularly natural way to live or to sleep, however. If you take yourself off artificial light, what will happen is after about 3 weeks, you'll start to wake up after 4 hours of rest to a kind of a 2-hour period in the middle of the night where you experience a tremendous peace and spiritual inner clarity that otherwise is very hard to attain. Now Ware said that he believes that what people are trying to reclaim through meditation, it is a state of mind that was once the birthright, what people would have considered their due.
You write in the book, the point of the dark revolt is to discover a new path that is really the old path.
Right.
So talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, a few years ago, I ran across a Wikipedia graph charting the rise in population of the subspecies Homo sapiens sapiens over a small but decisive period of its very, very long history, about 12,000 years from the dawn of agriculture down to the present day. And if you type in the words population growth or world population into Wikipedia and you go to images, you'll see that graph. And the graph hugs the bottom of the page for about 9,000 years, and then it starts to bump a little bit. And when it gets to the Industrial Revolution, it goes straight up. So I looked at this, and I looked at it like most modern people, and I saw basically a growth chart. So I thought, wow, you know, if you'd known to put your money on this little hairless species of hominid about 12,000 years ago, look at where you'd be now, right? Because it's just totally boomed. It's taken over the whole planet. It's repurposed all of the natural resources for its own sole use. So, but I realized that was the wrong way to look at it. And so I imagined actually printing it out, lying it out flat, and then turning it 90 degrees so that it didn't form a growth chart, but rather a path. And so here's this idea. You've got this path that goes back millions of years that we've come on. It's a fairly straight line. The human population was pretty much in sync with the planet, what it could provide with other species. And then you get to the modern age, and because of agriculture, which is basically driven by light, by the effect that light has on the body, okay, it makes us more fertile. It makes us believe we're living in late August every day of the year, right? So we're wanting to reproduce and consume as many carbohydrates as we can. So what happens is we get to the Industrial Revolution, and suddenly we're taking a hard left turn. There's a man, John Holdren, who is Obama's chief science advisor. And a few years ago, he said, he described the impending catastrophe of global warming with the words, "We're in a car with bad brakes driving through the fog and headed for a cliff. We know for sure the cliff is out there. We just don't know exactly where it is." The interesting thing is he mentions, you know, when he interprets this for reporters at his press conference, he interprets everything except the road, which he doesn't mention. So the question is, how do we get on this road going off a cliff? We ought to really have as long a future ahead of us as we have a past behind us. But now through over-industrialization, through the preponderance of unnatural light that gives us more hours to consume, more hours to obsess over progress and perfection and a growth economy, we're headed nowhere going fast.
You say in the book that through your intuition, you see this darkness as being female.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's not me alone. I think that if you look at the myths and spiritual traditions and stories of the world, you'll find that the feminine is generally regarded as dark, the masculine is light. The classic example is the yin-yang symbol, right?
Yes.
Where the yin side is dark and the light side is yang, which is masculine. So, but each contains the seed of the other within it. So it's not a binary kind of thing, right? It's not a deterministic thing. There are women who have, who embody that sort of, you know, bright, very deterministic, determined sort of male approach to life. And there are men who, you know, side more with the receptive and feminine side of things. But the darkness really is associated with women and with female ways of knowing traditionally in cultures around the world. And we've very much lost touch with that.
How does knowing that, of knowing and intuiting this female presence, help us, do you think, be able to connect more with the darkness?
Well, that feminine presence is traditionally much more connected with the earth and with its rhythms, you know, including the rhythm of the rising and setting of the sun. And to the degree that we're able to begin to live more in harmony with those ancient patterns, including the biggest pattern of all, which is literally day and night, the shifting of the seasons, the more we can bring ourselves back on the footpath toward that way of life and that kind of harmony, the better off we are, the better off other species are, the better off the planet is overall.
Where does your optimism lie that we'll get back on track? Because it seems that we are very reliant on light.
Right.
We do see glimmers just in the news a week or so ago about New York City looking to dim the skyline.
Right.
So there is an awareness.
Right, right.
But where do we go from here?
Well, I think that, you know, it's not a one-click fix, so to speak. I don't think that human beings are going to be able to scale back their own use of artificial light without some sort of pushback from the planet itself. And we're seeing that now. We're finding that it affects the migrations of birds. We're finding that it's not good for the human body. Certain types of light cause cancer rates, for instance, to skyrocket. Okay, if you fall asleep with one of those screens that emit blue light that we're all so famous, infatuated with, if you have one of those glowing next to you while you're sleeping, it significantly increases your chances, for instance, of getting cancer. So they're going to be, we're going to run up increasingly against natural limits, okay, of what we can do with light. And so that's going to serve as a kind of a corrective in and of itself. But I think also as we begin to deplete our energy reserves going forward over the next century, then I think we're going to find that we can't produce light at the levels we have now. So, you know, we'll get helped along with it.
Clark Strand is our guest. The name of the new book is Waking Up to the Dark, Ancient Wisdom for a Sleepless Age. That idea from childhood of being afraid of the dark.
Right.
Where does that come from?
Well, you know, I think that it's largely a modern creation. If you take a child and you put a child alone in a room in the dark, they're going to cry. For one thing, they're going to follow this same primordial pattern of waking in the middle of the night that's natural for human beings because it hasn't really been conditioned out of them yet by the culture. So they wake observing that pattern in the middle of the night. And if they're alone, they cry for their parents. If they're in bed with their mother and father, where, you know, by all rights, they probably should be, if we look historically at human beings and how they originally slept, they're not going to cry. They're still going to wake, but they're not going to cry. When my daughter was very young, we, you know, as new parents, followed the prevailing wisdom of the 90s and tried to Ferberize her, to let her cry herself back to sleep, but we couldn't take it. She wasn't a very good candidate for Ferberizing. She resisted it. So we eventually brought her into bed with us, but she would still wake up in the middle of the night. She just wouldn't cry. Sometimes I would wake because I've followed that pattern for a long time, and she'd be right there beside me, and she'd say, "Hi."
Right.
She was already awake.
I guess I'm looking for the right word as far as what it is in us to wake up in the middle of the night. And is that designed? Are we designed then to fall back to sleep? Is that the idea?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, in pre-modern times, they had a name for it. They called it the first and second sleep of the night. And you can find evidence of this in Homer, the Upanishads, in the Quran, in the Bible. They're always waking up to pray, to attend to the animals, to make love, and then they'll fall back to sleep. A lot of the visions that are supposed to have occurred in ancient times, on which our sacred scriptures are based, occurred during this time. So it's a time when the veil is very, very thin, when you know, people have visions in the dark that inform their lives. They receive wisdom and comfort and guidance.
And this is where that whole idea of, well, I'll sleep on it comes
right.
from.
You know, I think so. I never thought about that, Joe, but I think you're absolutely right. I'll sleep on it. Like something will happen in the night that my head can't figure out by day to give me the answer I seek.
Well, I think most of us have had those moments where we have gone to sleep with an issue
right.
and something on our minds, and
yeah.
we have woken up with a little bit of clarity.
Right, right. I think so. You know, we think that the more light we shed on issues, the clearer they're going to get. There's a sort of an innate bias in favor of the light, like that all things can be made clear. But the light sometimes blinds us, and the levels of light that we endure today blind us to certain things about ourselves and about our environment and one another. And those kinds of things, I think, become clearer in the middle of the night when we wake to that kind of, you know, soft, almost very, very faintly luminescent darkness, as if there were just a tad of moon shining through the window. That happens in our mind as well.
Is it always going to be natural light versus natural darkness of being the preferred method as opposed to finding light, artificial light,
right.
that is more pleasing to our systems?
Right. Well, I think, you know, there was a famous Trappist abbot one time who said, pray as you can, not as you can't. And so I think it's very important to find a place to start. So one thing, you know, people can do is that they can purchase light bulbs that reproduce natural light, okay, and that will help things along. Another thing is simply to turn out the lights a little earlier each night. You'll feel better. You'll sleep better. And if you keep trending in that direction, eventually what you'll find is that you start to get sort of naturally drowsy a couple of hours after dusk and head towards bed. You get to bed a little sooner, you get more sleep. And eventually, what you'll find is that when you wake in the middle of the night, you're not waking to that eerie, predatory insomnia that so many of us experience that people call the hour of the wolf. You're going to be waking instead to the hour of God.
How did we screw things up with daylight savings time?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if it's a screw up or not. I mean, the world itself is on the same schedule. I have a funny story about that though. When I was a little boy, my mother left my natural father. They married very young, and so she left him not long after I was born, and moved back home with her mother to Forest City, Arkansas, which was a very dark part of the country at that time. And there was a man named Mr. Kelso who was her handyman. And he sort of adopted me because I didn't have a father, and he would take me all about. He used to take me fishing all the time. He was a man of few words. And I had heard something I didn't understand as a young boy, which is that he didn't observe the new time. And so I asked him one day when we were fishing, "Mr. Kelso, why don't you want to save time?" And he looked at me and he said, "Son, you can't save time. How are you going to get by in life if you don't understand a thing like that?" But he used to, people would have to, you know, they would contract with him for work and they'd have to figure in the daylight savings time into it because he would never go on daylight savings.
In a chapter in the book called Hour of the Wolf, you write, "What is to become of us? That is the question waiting for us in the dark. We don't really have the answer. We have beliefs and hopes, but we don't have any knowledge of the world to come. We only know that we were born and that we will die, and that the time we have left is steadily shrinking. With each passing day, with each heartbeat, with every breath we take, our time can only run out. It makes us upset. It makes us panic. And so we cry inwardly, what is to become of us? It isn't really a question."
Yes.
And that struck me because I think a lot of us think of it as a question with an answer.
Yeah, well, I think it is a question with an answer, what is to become of us. But unfortunately, what's happened to us in the modern age is that we have all of these spiritual scriptures and texts telling us what happens like after death. We still have them, and there's still the expectation that we will believe them. But trying to believe in these ancient scriptures as a modern person and what they say about the afterlife without actually having any experience of those kinds of states of mind where you might be able to perceive the other world, is a kind of a losing proposition. I do believe that people who meditate today and pray, go on retreats, people who follow a paleo diet, for instance, all of these people who are trying their best to recover that lost channel to the divine that began to shut down when people started to compress their sleep nights like their work days into convenient 8-hour blocks. Thomas Ware said at the end of his study that he believed that it was an open channel to the divine that once stood open for every human being. And I sometimes call it a nightly meditation retreat for every Homo sapiens on Earth. But we've suppressed that and lost touch with it. But waking up in the middle of the night and allowing yourself to experience that peace and the state of mind that sort of naturally unfolds in people, which Ware compared to what people experience in the deepest states of meditation, that can give us the kind of contact with the world beyond that we've lost as human beings, and it can restore our religious faith in a certain way.
Realizing that there are great variances, of course, but we have now programmed ourselves to, if some of us wake up for even a short period of time, it becomes a diagnosis of insomnia, insomniac.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that makes billions for big pharma, that's for sure. But I think it's largely a misconception. We don't really wake in the middle of the night because there's something wrong with us. We wake because we're supposed to. And this experiment has been replicated again and again. You can really take just about anybody off the street, remove them from artificial lighting, and within 1 month, they will begin to sleep in two blocks, waking in the middle of the night. And so, you know, this is really, it's a lost state of consciousness, but it's still there encoded within us. All we really have to do to get back to it, okay, is to turn off the lights.
I, as an interviewer, believe there, of course, the old adage is there's no such thing as a stupid question. I don't believe that to be true. I believe there certainly are stupid questions, and I'm going to permit myself to ask one now, which is, if your eyes are shut,
right,
how available are you to the effects of light?
You know, you're still completely subject to the effects of light. It's a common misconception. I didn't know this myself until I started to
research. So it's not a dumb question.
It's not a dumb question. Yeah, it's a question.
Make you feel better, Clark.
Absolutely. It's a question I had. And what I learned is that we have photoreceptor cells in our skin. All of our cells respond to light. Light is the master switch for hormone production in the body. And so even, for instance, a blind person who doesn't take in, you know, visual images through their eyes and process them in their visual cortex, they're still subject to the same pattern of the rising and falling of the sun. And if they have the lights on in their house, it will affect them negatively and actually suppress their melatonin production.
I noticed this because I used to live in a village and we had street lights and there were lights on and lights off, and you would have obviously light coming in. And then I moved out into the country and there is no outside light other than moonlight.
Right.
And my sleep is very different.
Oh,
I notice
yeah.
my sleep to be very, very different
yeah.
because
yeah.
there is, it's very dark.
Yeah, you sleep better in the darkness. There's no doubt about it. And even tiny little lights like indicator lights, sleep lights on computers, things like that can actually interrupt our sleep. If, as much as possible, if you can sleep in darkness, find a way to do that. Sometimes that's very hard, but if you can do it, it improves your health, it improves your sleep and your state of mind.
So even those little lights make a difference, you believe?
Yeah, even those. When Ware did his study, he struggled to eliminate even the smallest bit of light from the environment of the subjects of his study. And there are studies that have been done, for instance, with lab rats. This is one of the more fascinating studies about light. What they found was that in order to produce control groups for instance, for cancer studies, the rats couldn't be, in the control group, couldn't be exposed to any artificial light at all after dark. In other words, they had to be kept in a perfectly dark room in order to get baseline rates of cancer in these rats. Otherwise, if they were exposed to even a little bit, like a red blinking light or something like that, it would actually make them more subject or more likely to get cancer than the rats that were kept in the dark. And so now most places that produce lab rats and most studies that are done, the control groups for the rats, include rats that are kept in total darkness at least half of the day.
Given your Buddhist background, how did the two of these come together? Was it natural?
I think so. I didn't really know how my wandering in the middle of the night was connected to my drive to practice Buddhism. Now, Ware said, and I think he's right, that people who practice meditation are trying to reclaim that state of mind that naturally occurs in the middle of the night. And I think I was seeking that when I went off to become a Buddhist monk. The monastery I lived in was mostly candlelit. It was in the mountains, miles and miles from any street lamps or artificial light. And so I felt, very at peace there more than I would have, but I didn't associate it somehow with light. Like it was sort of invisible to me then. I hadn't made the connection between darkness and meditation at that point. That would only come much later.
The name of the book is Waking Up to the Dark, Ancient Wisdom for a Sleepless Age. It is published by Random House, Spiegel & Graw. Clark Strand, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for
sharing
with us. I appreciate it. Again, Waking Up to the Dark is the name of the book. It's published by Spiegel & Gras. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.